Genesis 3:15 is where we want to start today.
The gospel, the good news of the atoning death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ was first preached in Genesis 3:15. In Genesis 3:15, you have the theme of the Bible and the first promise of a Redeemer. God tells the serpent that I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed. He, that is, her seed, shall bruise you, the serpent, on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. You have a contrast between wounds that are inflicted upon enemies in the last two lines of the verse, and the seed of the woman inflicts the greater wound upon the serpent. And as you study the Bible, you see that the son of the, or the seed of the woman, Jesus of Nazareth, overcame the powers of the devil through his death, burial, and resurrection. When you look in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 24, after his resurrection, Jesus himself, Luke chapter 24 and verse 27, Jesus begins to show to Cleopas and the unnamed disciple on the road that the law of Moses foretold the death, burial, and resurrection of the Messiah. In chapter 24 and verse 27, then beginning with Moses and with all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. If he begins with Moses, he's going to begin in Genesis. May very well have mentioned Genesis 3 and verse 15. Further down in this chapter, in verse 44, he speaks to the 11, and he tells them, "These are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you, that all things which are written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." One of the major arguments that evangelists in the first century made to convert people to Christianity was that all of this had been foretold and promised by men that were credited by God by signs, miracles, and wonders to be prophets. In fact, you find that very argument being made by Peter in Acts chapter 2, the first gospel sermon. Look over in Acts chapter 2. In Acts 2, Peter submits four pieces of evidence to convince this audience of Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. And one of them is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 24, after he mentions that the people he's speaking to murdered Jesus by demanding that he be crucified, he said in verse 24, "But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power." Well, why was it impossible? He explains that in verse 25. "For David says of him," David, whom these people regarded and accepted in verse 30 as a prophet, was speaking for God. And Peter's argument is that it was impossible for Jesus to be held in the grave because God made a promise. And when God makes a promise, he's going to carry it through. So in the first century, you have these prophecies that are appealed to as evidence that Jesus was exactly who he claimed to be. We live in a different world. We live not in a world where the people that you speak to in a large audience already believe that the Old Testament was written by the Lord. Now, you may find people like that, friends, acquaintances, co-workers, but times have changed quite a lot. I've got a book that I use in my studies on this subject. It's by Lee Strobel, The Case for the Real Jesus, published in 2007. He said, according to a landmark 2006 study by professors from Harvard and George Mason universities, the percentage of atheists and agnostics teaching at U.S. colleges is three times greater than in the population as a whole. You think, well, I don't care. I'm not going back to school. I've already graduated. What about your children? Your grandchildren? Your great-grandchildren? More likely than not, their professors, if given the opportunity, will do what they can to try to undermine their faith. More than half of college professors believe the Bible is an ancient book of fables, legends, history, and moral precepts, compared to less than one-fifth of the general population. Now, that's 10 years ago, so both of these percentages, I'm sure, are a bit higher than they were even in 2006 when the study was published. One of the things that people will hear in a college campus, or if they just turn on the news at times, or even just in casual conversation with people that really don't know much about the Bible, other than what they've heard about it, and most of the time that's inaccurate, is this. These prophecies that people appealed to in the Old Testament were all made up after the fact. Now, if that's true, what does that do for Peter's argument when he says in Acts 2 and verse 24, God raised him up again just like he said he would? Exactly. The whole thing comes crashing down. Another thing that people might hear is this. Well, yeah, that book you've got in your lap, sure. In Genesis and in the writings of David, like Peter appeals to here and in other places, sure, it looks like Jesus is foretold. But that's not really what those people said originally. The Bible, as we have it, is just like a game of telephone. Everybody know the game of telephone? So if you don't, raise your hand. Okay. The game of telephone works like this. Let's say I whisper something into Alex's ear, and then he whispers it to Margaret, and then on and on and on and on. And then when we get down to Brandon, and I ask Brandon, okay, what's the message that you received? In the game of telephone, the final message that the last person relays to everybody else most of the time is not what was originally said to Alex. That's part of the fun of the game. You want to see just how wild and crazy the final message is from the first one that was given to the first person. If that's true about the Bible, which is what people say, then whatever was originally written in the book of Genesis thousands of years ago has been lost. And over time, what people thought they heard Moses say, if he's even the one that wrote it, and what people thought they heard David say, if he's even the one that wrote this psalm, it just got corrupted and it got twisted, and now it just looks like the Bible foretold what was going to happen thousands of years beforehand. So, how do you answer these kind of things? I hope by now that if you are not already interested in knowing much about Greek translations of the Old Testament or the Dead Sea Scrolls, that maybe by now you can see the practical value in it. I realize this is the kind of study that a lot of people just don't get into, but I think you'll see that this is very beneficial to our faith to know about this. Look in 1 Peter chapter 2. As you're turning to 1 Peter chapter 2, I'll tell you, and you already know this probably if you've read it, in verse 22, talking about the suffering of Jesus and using this as a pattern for how Christians that likewise suffered for their faith should react against those that brought harm upon them. He mentions Jesus in verse 22, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. Where does he quote from?
Isaiah.
Specifically, Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53, one of the most famous passages in all the Old Testament about the Messiah. Now, let's see. We have a professor of Isaiah in the room. Rocky? When did Isaiah prophesy? Do you remember?
700 years before Christ.
Okay, so 700 BC. How many original copies of that manuscript that Isaiah wrote do we have?
None.
When did David write? Go back over to Acts 2. In Acts chapter 2, where we mentioned a moment ago, Peter quotes from the Psalms and the things that David wrote. Verses 25 through 28, he quotes from Psalm 16. This is one of the Psalms that predicted the resurrection. Verse 27, you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You've made known to me the ways of life. Make me full of gladness in your presence. And so he points out that David's body is still in the tomb. So David was not talking about himself, had to be talking about someone else. And he mentions the promise that God made to him in verse 30 for one of his descendants to reign on his throne forever. Therefore, it must refer to this descendant of David whose tomb is now empty in this city. Anybody know when David lived and when he would have written this? About 1000 B.C. How many of the original manuscripts by the hand of David do we have today? None. We quoted from Genesis 3:15 at the start of the class. When did Moses live? About, 1,500 years or so, roughly, prior to Jesus. So you're talking about a book that's 3,500 years old. How many of the originals of anything that Moses wrote do we have?
None
whatsoever. Then what do we have? Copies. Copies and copies and copies and copies of copies and copies of copies and copies of copies. Over and over and over.
But they are weird copies, I believe.
Yes, they are. They are. Yes. Don't get ahead of me, Ennis. Yeah. We have revered copies. In Acts chapter 2, verses 25 through 28, when Peter quotes from the Old Testament, he is not quoting from a Hebrew copy of the Old Testament. Does anybody know what the common tongue of the New Testament, specifically where the Middle East was in particular, what the common tongue of their day was?
Greek.
And the reason for that is because in between Malachi and Matthew, Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East and much, much, much further east of that as well. And after he took over the Middle East, Greek became the language of trade, of commerce, of everyday life. And after the collapse of the Greek Empire, the Romans took over, but still, in the eastern portion of the Roman Empire, people still spoke Greek. And though you never read of Greece actually being in charge in any of the books of the Bible that we have, you feel the aftershocks of their rule over the region, even in the New Testament. They spoke Greek. They had Greek names. Philip was a Greek name. Philip of Macedon was the father of Alexander the Great. And in Acts 6, you read about the Hellenistic Jews. And Hellenistic Jews were people that had Greek custom, Greek language, Greek culture. They were more Greek than they were Jewish in the way they thought and the way they lived. So we have Greek. And then in verses 25 through 28, we have not a quotation from Hebrew, but from Greek. After Alexander the Great conquered the Middle East, the Old Testament was translated into Greek. This is called the Septuagint. This is point number one on page 12 of the lesson. If you have a Bible with footnotes in it, sometimes they will make reference to the Septuagint. They always abbreviate it with the Latin number 70, LXX. And you may not have known that that's what this is referring to, but that's what they're letting you know. They're referencing something from the Septuagint. The Septuagint is helpful because of when it was compiled. It was translated somewhere between 250 to 100 BC. Somewhere in that span of time, this came together. So what that tells me is this. At the very latest, when Peter quotes from this prophecy in Acts 2, when he quotes from Isaiah in 1 Peter 2, in Acts chapter 4, when Luke mentions another prophecy, Acts 4 and verse 26, this time quoting from the book of Psalms again, Psalm 2, the kings of the earth took their stand, the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against his Christ. So the conspiracy between the high priest, Herod, and Pilate was foretold 1,000 years before it happened. When they quote from these passages, they're quoting from a Greek translation of the Hebrew, and this lets me know that at the very minimum, these prophecies are 100 years older than Jesus Christ. Now, maybe somebody you're talking to says, I don't believe that they knew how to write all the way back in the time of Moses, all the way back in the time of David. Just forget all that for a second. At the very least, And I believe they're much older than that, but at the very least, they are a century older than the events that you read about in the New Testament. That's pretty incredible. What if in the 1860s, someone had predicted that roughly 100 years later, there would be a Catholic president who was a war veteran, who would be assassinated before the completion of his first term in office? That would be remarkable even 100 years before it happened. Of course, by looking at the manuscripts that we have, and also giving the text that we have the benefit of the doubt as to when the events recorded took place, you can see that they're much older than 100 years. 700 years, 1,000 years, 3,500 years old. Incredible. This proves that the prophecies of Jesus were not made up after the fact. Now, in our class, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on the Old Testament prophecies. I want to spend more time on the New Testament and defending it, but I at least want to talk about the Old Testament and how we got it, because this is such a credit to our faith. Look over in Isaiah 53. So the Septuagint was a Greek translation of a Hebrew text that we no longer have. It was based on the Hebrew text that they had at the time, but of course those originals have been lost. Even our originals of the Septuagint have been lost by now. It's hard to keep anything on paper or papyrus or whatever around for 2,000 years. Now let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. Prior to these being discovered, the oldest manuscripts for the Old Testament that we had dated back to 900 AD. What that means is, for a long time, we were in the strange position of having New Testament manuscripts that were hundreds of years older than our Old Testament manuscripts. We had an Old Testament text called the Masoretic Text, which dated back to 900 AD. And they believe that was a copy of another copy that dated back a few hundred years earlier, but that was as far back as we could go. And for a lot of scholars, this was kind of a troubling thing, because they wondered, how can I really know? How can I really know that what Isaiah says in my copy today is what it said for thousands of years? In 1947, a shepherd boy, just a few miles outside of Jericho, was playing, picked up a rock and threw it in a cave. And when he threw it in the cave, he heard some pottery break. And he went inside of the cave and investigated and found these jars that had all these scrolls in them. And some people came along and they bought the scrolls, and some went to Israel and some went to North America and some to Europe, I think. And nobody that didn't already know ancient Hebrew or Hebrew period could make much sense of them until they unfurled them and started to investigate them. Lo and behold, they discovered this is an incredible find, because the Dead Sea Scrolls date back to about 100 BC. The Isaiah scroll dates back to 125 BC. What they realized by looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls and the text they had from 900 AD was that for 1,000 years, Isaiah said the exact same thing. The Old Testament said the exact same thing. And that is rare. Very rare. It's also interesting that these texts were even found in 1947. What just ended in 1945?
World War II.
And when Great Britain got involved in World War II, so did all of her colonies. The Middle East was one of her colonies. They depended on oil from the Middle East to maintain their empire. This was a war-torn region. To even find these things is remarkable. And then to discover them and then investigate them and see just how old they are is incredible in and of itself. This includes a complete copy of Isaiah. It's 24 feet long. Now, what's the big deal about Isaiah? Isaiah 53. In Isaiah 53, in verse 4, you read of the suffering Messiah. Surely our griefs he himself bore, our sorrows he carried, yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted.
He was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. You've got scourging in the last line. Then you have pierced through. What would that be a reference to in the first line? Okay. Perhaps. Nails in his hands and feet. Crucifixion. The two things that did him in. The scourging and the crucifixion. Now, Isaiah was written 700 B.C., right, Rocky? So, when did crucifixion actually start to show up on the scene? Well, it wasn't, according to some of the sources I've checked, it wasn't even widely practiced until at least 100 years after Isaiah. Darius the Great, who is mentioned in the book of Ezra and Haggai, he crucified 3,000 people from Babylon. He was a Persian ruler, and he'd conquered Babylon, and they had a revolt, so he punished them with 3,000 crucifixions. That was 519 B.C. That's almost 200 years after Isaiah is even written. So here is a text that we know has survived intact for 1,000 years, and at least 125 years before the Messiah even came. His death by crucifixion and scourging was prophesied in Isaiah 53 and verse 5. Remarkable. Now, what do these things look like? There's a link on the page itself. If you want to pull up some pictures on the internet, you can do that. If you want to see a portion of it yourself, you can go to Spring at Lanier Theological Library. There is a small fragment of Amos, fits in the palm of your hand over there. It's 2,000 years old. That's Virginia colony, started 1607. That's five times the age of the oldest state in the Union. You can get in there to see it for free. Under no circumstances can you take a picture. They don't allow any of that to happen. And you got to be very, very quiet because the slightest step makes a huge echo in that place. That's over in Spring, about 25 minutes away from here. What this confirmed was the integrity of the copies that we had and the prophecies that they contain. So if anybody wants to know, how do you know this wasn't all made up after the fact? Septuagint. The Dead Sea Scrolls. How do you know it wasn't a big game of telephone? Dead Sea Scrolls. Confirms it. And what they do, they'll take the Septuagint, they'll take the Dead Sea Scrolls, they'll take other ancient manuscripts like the Samaritan Pentateuch, and they compare them. And they'll find remarkable consistency in all these different texts that show that there's not been massive corruption of the text down through the ages. Any questions or comments about how we date and how we know the accuracy of our Old Testament is dependable? Keith?
I'm assuming that these are all secular historians, meaning they're not Christians who are finding this. And it's not, there's no way to, I guess, that's a good word for it, bias. There's no bias involved in this, in the sense that it's not Christians finding it, Christians claiming that this is widely accepted among just normal historians, correct?
Well, first of all, bias, like we said Wednesday night, in and of itself, that's not a problem. Who runs the Holocaust museums?
Jews.
They biased?
Yes.
Yeah, they are. They got skin in the game. They don't want anybody to forget the Holocaust, but they've done some of the best scholarship on the Holocaust. Some of the people that study these, they're believers. And we may not agree that they're Christians necessarily, but they believe in Jesus. But the scrolls themselves, a lot of them are kept in Israel, and those people are not Christians by any stretch, and it would be charitable to even call them Jewish in the sense of their faith many times. Much of modern Israel is made up of secular Jews that are only Jewish culturally and not religiously. So bias in of itself, I don't know that has any bearing one way or the other. They're still accepted and respected as legitimate archaeological finds that validate the text that we have. Yes?
Whatever they were scribing or transferring from one book to another,
it was going to be exact.
Right. They were very scrupulous about it. They're very strict in their procedures. They had a lot of checks and balances into the system. And the finds that we have here certainly confirm that. So another hand up? Yes.
Do you know anything about how they were dated? Like, I'm sure it has, you're not an archaeologist, but did the scribes date them, or was it a process of how it was dated to 100 BC? Do you know?
They date them by the materials that are used. They can compare them with...
like the type of parchment or copper?
The style of handwriting. Handwriting changes from generation to generation. The type of ink that's used, any number of methods to determine how these things are dated. The same process is used as well to date the New Testament manuscripts that we have. John?
Well, they've even been carbon dated. I know we, you know, throw carbon dating out of the window on some things, you know, but this is something you can go back at them. You know, the people who rely on carbon dating, the Dead Sea Scrolls, I thought, because there were, I think, three Isaiah scrolls, only one complete, and I thought one of the other Isaiah scrolls was 200 B.C. I may be wrong about that, but I thought it was carbon dated back that far.
I don't know. Not familiar with that. It'd be interesting if they did date it back that far. Even with the problems in carbon dating, it'd be interesting that they took it back that far. Yes?
Even if the scholars that did a majority of the work bias, there's plenty of unbelieving scholars that would expose the errors
that too.
Of their statement had it not been substantial.
That too, yeah. You have this is not like claiming some special revelation that comes within your mind and then you go and tell other people about it. There's an objective standard by which you could gauge any scholar's work by examining the text. Good point. All right, let's talk about our New Testament. So we have these books that tell us about this man Jesus that died and was buried, and then he arose and he appeared, made 12 distinct appearances to confirm that he was back from the dead. How do we know we can believe him? Do we have any of the originals of what Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul wrote? No, we don't. We don't. All we have are copies, but that in and of itself is not a problem. For example, we won't look at everything that we have on the chart here toward the bottom of page 12, but let's talk about a couple of these that we have. Anybody familiar with Homer's Iliad? Alex? You are? Anybody else? Have you seen the movie Troy? That's a loose retelling or loose adaptation of the Iliad, the story of the Trojan horse and the Trojan Wars and everything that supposedly went on there. It's regarded as a Greek epic that celebrates the best qualities of ancient Greek culture, or at least that's how the Greeks would have thought of it anyway. And it's been dated to have been written about 800 B.C. How many originals do we have of the Iliad to know that that's what was actually written by this man named Homer? None. Instead, we have copies. If you look on the far right, the top far right, you can see the number of copies that we have. This is interesting, 643 copies. That's a lot. Give me just a second, Ronnie. Shows that this was a treasured text, if nothing else. But the gap that we have between the oldest copies and when the original was written is 400 years. We have a copy of this that dates back to 400 BC, 400 years after the original was first written. And yet, the Iliad is studied far and wide today in schools, in colleges, everywhere. Yes, sir?
Well, in a way, the Homer doesn't really exactly apply. I mean, it is the one of the Greek texts that you've got as most copies. And it was written down in 800 B.C. It's a couple of hundred years older than that, because it was an oral poem that Homer created, but wasn't written down for 100 or 200 years after he created it. So, you know, whether we even have in these copies what Homer was actually saying is a question that a lot of people have.
Okay.
Whereas in our texts, the guys who were supposed to be doing the speaking in most
Right. In most cases, not all. We have some where we would have a written record of oral preaching, which would be Luke's case in his gospel and in Acts. So there.
If you go back to the Old Testament, you know, the Kings and Chronicles.
Right.
We don't have Elijah and Elisha actually write their own stuff.
Right.
But all these others are supposed to be what those authors wrote down. Whereas Homer is, like I say, what they wrote down quite a while after he had died.
Okay. Okay. That's a good point to make. At the very least, we would point out that the Iliad, as it was transmitted, once it was put to paper, was at least a story that was widely accepted and regarded as worth preserving by ancient Greek culture as representing the best of their heritage. And as we have mentioned, it's hundreds of years after it was first composed or comprised by whomever. The second one that we have, yes.
It's really immaterial whether the original Iliad in 800 is what Homer said or not. It doesn't make a difference. That's not your point. Your point is our copies are considered accurate representations of the 800 writing.
Right.
That point, whether that was accurate or not, is really immaterial.
Yeah. Herodotus, with his history, this would be a history of the Persian Wars. Would have been written 480 to 425 BC. Look at the lag between the copies that we have of it and the original. 900 years. We only have 8 surviving copies, the oldest of which dates back to over 1,300 years after it was first written. I think I got those numbers mixed up. It's 1,300 years after it was written and dated back to 900 AD. And yet Herodotus is read and studied today as being an accurate source on what happened during the Persian Wars. And the copies are regarded to accurately represent what Herodotus first put down when he decided to set forth his history of what happened. And as you go down the list, you see that again and again. Julius Caesar, in his account of the Gallic Wars, he would have written this somewhere between 100 and 44 BC after he concluded his campaigns in Europe and then became emperor. The oldest copies that we have are 900 AD. That's 1,000 years later. We only got 10 of those, and yet they're regarded to accurately represent what he recorded in his history. Again and again, you find this going down. Now, all this tells us is that just because you don't have an original of a manuscript does not mean that you can't have some confidence in knowing what was first written by an author. You have copies that you can compare with one another, and if you have an abundance of copies, all the better, because then you have more sources to compare with one another from which you can discern what the original manuscript actually said. Now, if you look back up at the top at Homer's Iliad, the number of copies that we have, 643, that's a lot. This is by far the best attested ancient text that we have from antiquity, if you don't count the New Testament. When you get down to the bottom, we have the New Testament. Would have been written, of course, maybe 50 to 100 AD. Perhaps most, if not all, the books written before 70 AD. We have manuscript copies. We'll talk about some of the dates of those here in a few minutes that date hundreds of years after the fact. The time gap is much, much smaller than any of these other ancient texts that we have. And then if you look at the bottom far right, look at the sheer number of, and this is just Greek manuscripts, by the way. This is not every ancient manuscript we have for the New Testament. It's just the Greek. How many do we have?
Over
5,000, actually closer to 6,000. And if you count up everything that we have, not just in Greek, but in all the translations that were made into other languages, like Latin, like Syriac, the number is closer to 20,000. There is no book in ancient history that is better documented, better attested by sheer number of copies than the New Testament that you hold in your lap. So, this raises the question. Go back to Julius Caesar. if I can have confidence that the Gallic Wars, if I wanted to go and buy a copy of that today, if I can have confidence that the copy I buy is in fact what Julius Caesar wrote, with only 10 surviving copies, the oldest of which is 1,000 years after the original would have been written. If I can have confidence in that book, why can I not have confidence in the New Testament? Why can I not have confidence that when I pick up Matthew's Gospel, I actually have what Matthew wrote? Now, if you look on the next page, let's talk about some of these texts that we have here specifically. What this shows, by the way, is what we just talked about with the Dead Sea Scrolls. The accusation that's made is that the Bible is just a game of telephone. Somebody told a story, and then by the time it got put down to paper and then handed down to us, whatever that person originally said, it's just been lost. Who knows what people first believed or taught about whatever or whomever. None of that's true. The Dead Sea Scrolls, they say that's impossible. And the manuscripts that we have in the New Testament say it's impossible. Now, that doesn't prove that the manuscripts that we have are true in and of itself. It doesn't prove that the resurrection actually occurred. What it does prove is that I've got four books that say the exact same thing they said 2,000 years ago. I need to know that. I need to know that somebody didn't come along years later and make all this up. There's a very popular book that came out about 12 or 13 years ago that essentially made that argument. It's not a new argument. It's called The Da Vinci Code. People got together. There was a conspiracy. They got all the right fragments of books together. They edited them together, streamlined it, and created this remarkable story that has hoodwinked so many people down through the centuries. Well, if that's true, you might as well throw your Bible in the trash. Because my Bible depends on things like what Luke says in his prologue in chapter 1. Chapter 1 and verse 2, the things handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses. That's his claim to credibility. I spoke to people who were there. If I don't have what Luke wrote, I don't know what people did see or didn't see. I don't know if they saw anything if I don't have what he wrote. So I need to know that I've got an accurate transmission of what was first put to paper by this man. So, let's talk about what we have. From the copies that we have on page 13, goodness, if you look down on number 3, just the quotations alone, you hear sometimes people refer to the early Christian writings or the early church fathers. These are guys like Justin Martyr, Origen, Tertullian, etc. They would have written from the hundreds to the 300s. These guys quoted almost every single verse in the New Testament. There's just a few verses that were not recorded by them. If every single Greek manuscript of the New Testament were destroyed tomorrow, you could reconstruct your entire New Testament from what these men wrote alone. This book is remarkably preserved through history. It's not been corrupted and defiled like people would have us believe. Look up at the top, though, the 5,000 Greek manuscripts that we have. We've got one called the Alexandrian manuscript. It dates back to 375 to 425 AD, somewhere in there. And we may think, well, you know, that's just an awful lot of time behind when the originals were written. And it is. But it's shorter than a lot of those other books we've got on the next page. And again, if I can have confidence from those copies that they accurately represent what was first written, I can do that with these as well. The Sinaitic and Vatican manuscripts, if you use the New American Standard Bible, the English Standard Version, or the NIV, this is what your Bible is based on, these two manuscripts. The Vatican manuscript, that name alone tells you who owns this manuscript. It's been in Rome since 1491, I think. Let me double check. The Sinaitic manuscript, it's the Vatican manuscript. It has almost the entire New Testament in it. It's missing the last half of Mark 16. Sometimes you'll see in your Bible a footnote that says some manuscripts don't have the last half of Mark 16. It's missing that. Interestingly, it does have a blank space left for it, though. The Alexandria manuscript, the first one there, you think, well, how do we know all this stuff exists? Did some guy just make this up in a history book? If you go to London, go to the British Museum. And if you go to the British Museum, you'll see the Alexandrian manuscript right there. And it includes much of the New Testament. Drop down to the bottom two there, E and F. The Chester Beatty Papyri. This manuscript contains the four Gospels and Acts. That's very important for us because we're talking about the resurrection. Those are the five of the six books that talk about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. It's dated to 150 A.D. If you have a copy dated in 150 A.D., what does that tell you about the original? It's older. If the copy is dated 150 A.D., the original is older than that. The John Rylands manuscript contains John 18. John 18 is when Jesus is before Pilate, just before his crucifixion. So this is from what's called the Passion narrative of the Gospel, right? Just before he goes to the cross. This dates to 130 A.D. Now this one, let's see, was discovered in Egypt. How fast did news travel 2,000 years ago? It's not in the Middle East. It's moving pretty slow. It's found in Egypt. What that tells you, if it's found in Egypt, it took a while to get there. So if it's dated to 130 AD, that means the original is showing up somewhere else farther away, even earlier than the date that we have here. When I look at the manuscripts that we have, I like to think of these as a ripple in a pond. If you're walking, you go to a state park and there's a pond there, and you see a ripple hit the pond, what does that ripple tell you? Maybe a rock or something fell into the water. Something disturbed the water, right? You know from observing that ripple that something has been there. These things are like a ripple in the pond, but they're better than that. I may not ever know what actually disturbed the water. It could have been a rock, could have been an acorn, could have been whatever. These things not only tell you what came before to produce the ripple, they tell you what exactly came before to produce the ripple. You know exactly what these men wrote when they wrote it. As well, we have all the different versions that survived through the years. We have Jerome's Latin Vulgate. This would have been some of these translations. They date back to the 2nd century, the 100s. Our copies are not that old, but scholars can infer that they go back at least to that time. And again, what that tells you is if all the copies show up that early in history, then the originals come before it. So in our next class, what we'll do is we'll look at the evidence that we have that dates these books internally. That's a key component of trying to figure out how old these manuscripts are. And then we want to talk about all the mistakes in them. The word that you should use is variances. But if somebody tells you, you know, those manuscripts that you have, they have a lot of errors in them, you say, you're right, they do. Almost three times as many errors in our manuscripts as there are words. The question is, what kind of errors do we have? Do we have some manuscripts that say Jesus walked on water and another that says he walked on the moon? Do we have some that say Mary was a virgin and others that say she wasn't? Or are the errors things like spelling, which don't really affect the meaning of the message? That's the question, and we'll talk about that, Lord willing, next time.